Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. For over three decades in American history, Willie Sutton was America's most successful bank robber. Sutton became so good at breaking into banks and such a master at breaking out of prisons, police called him one of the most dangerous men in New York, and the FBI put him on the first ever most wanted list. Sutton is the much-anticipated debut novel from Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and best-selling author J.R. Moehringer, based on the life of this beloved bank robber. Known as a hero to many during his time for robbing the banks that robbed the people, Sutton is driven by only two things, a lost love and a deep hatred of banks. J.R. Moehringer is the author of the 2006 best-selling memoir, The Tender Bar. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism in 2000, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
At what point did you know in your writing life that you wanted to write a novel?
That was always the goal. I knew that I wanted to make a living writing for newspapers. I loved journalism. I started, you know, my earliest writing was in journalism in high school and college, the newspapers. But, the novel was always the thing. My first writer heroes were the great novelists, Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Faulkner. Fiction is my first choice, always. I love short stories, I love novels, and I always hoped that I would be able to find a way to make that part of my life.
So many of us got to know you and got to know your name through The Tender Bar, which of course was a beautiful memoir. Following that book and following the success of that book, I assume there's a decision that says, okay, now what am I going to write my novel about? What went into that decision and brought you to the life of Sutton?
My whole life, having said that I always wanted to be a novelist, my whole life has been deciding, okay, I'm going to write this story as a novel, and then having to backtrack and eventually write it as nonfiction. I think I might have even talked to Andre Agassi about when I worked with him on his memoir about writing it as a novel instead. I decided that I was going to write a novel about Willie Sutton because it was time to write a novel, and I thought maybe a nonfiction book would be better. I mean, you always toggle back and forth. You look at the story and you try and decide, does this make more sense to tell this as nonfiction or does it make more sense to tell it as fiction? With my memoir, I originally thought I would write that as a novel. And then an editor who I really revered said, why don't you consider writing this as nonfiction? And that was really the eureka moment for me because I thought that my attempts to fictionalize the bar where I grew up were never as interesting as the actual truth. And so I as soon as he said, why don't you try this as nonfiction, I could see the whole book before me. With Willie Sutton, there's so much that's not known about him that it would be impossible to write a nonfiction book. And so I became excited. I thought, well, here's finally a topic that I want to write as a novel, and it makes sense to write it as a novel. So it seemed serendipitous.
When you think of the story, you still had the possibility, the choice to write something completely from your imagination or go to something historical with a character that is very vivid and certainly was well known and, as we mentioned in the introduction, beloved by many. So what led you in that direction as opposed to just making it up?
What led me in the direction of...
You have the choice then of in writing a novel to write a mm-hmm. story that is completely fictional or to
right.
look at something that is already established and fictionalize
right.
a nonfiction event.
I mean, it all started with the financial crisis. It was late 2008. It was 2009. I was finishing up with Agassi. I had another idea for a novel. I had done a lot of work on it, but I was watching television every day and watching the world end. I was growing angrier and angrier because the calamity was man-made, and the men who made it seemed just supremely unrepentant and, in fact, were demanding that the government, that we clean up the mess that they had made. And so I started to think I'd rather write about this anger than this other novel that I've been working on. And my anger was focused on banks, and I thought of ways of writing about that anger. And that got me to thinking about people who hated banks almost as much as I do, and that got me thinking about bank robbers. And that made me think of Willie Sutton, the most famous American bank robber. And I thought, well, that would be a really interesting way of looking at how banks have completely jobbed us, why we send bank robbers to jail for 50 years, but bankers who rob us, we give them $100 million bonuses. And I thought about bank robbery itself as a uniquely American act. I mean, like jazz and baseball and spray tanning, bank robbery is kind of an American art form. And so Willie Sutton was the greatest practitioner of that art form. In fact, 20 banks a day are robbed in this country, roughly. Those are the last numbers I saw. And bank robbers remember Willie Sutton. A lot of the tactics that they use today were innovated by him. And recently in Brooklyn, a bank robber left a note saying, "I'm the new Willie Sutton." So if you've forgotten Willie Sutton, bank robbers haven't. All these things were swirling around in my mind, and I thought, maybe it's a great way to get at this banking crisis by inhabiting the skin of this fascinating, enigmatic, dangerous, charming bank robber. And the more I read about him, the more I realized that this was a book I could see myself writing, and that it would also be cathartic to write it because of what we were suffering as a country at the hands of banks.
Your baseline knowledge of Sutton's hatred of banks was what?
He wrote two memoirs. He certainly expressed a kind of a wry malice towards banks in those books. And in my book, I'm careful not to make him out to be a one-man crusader against banks. In fact, the journalists that he's riding around with in my book are more anxious to depict him as a rebel against society and against banks than he is, because I think that even he didn't know his own motivations. I think I went into this book hating banks more than he, and came out of it convinced that I still hate them more than he. It was just cathartic for me to rob a bunch of imaginary banks with him riding shotgun. For him, the real Willie Sutton, I think he had a complex set of impulses. I mean, I think it's not coincidental that one of his first jobs was at a bank as a teenager and that he was fired from that bank. I think that certainly played a role in his career choice. But he was also motivated by economic conditions, inability to find a job. I think there must have been some trauma in his home life, which I imagine in the book. There's a lost love at the core of who he was. His first crime was committed with his first love. She was his first accomplice. All of these things combined to make him the bank robber that he was. I try carefully in the book not to depict him as simply a kind of monomaniacal, anti-bank, one-man Occupy movement.
There is a passage that reads, "Mr. Untermyer clears his throat. May I ask you something, Willie? Sure thing. What's it like to rob a bank?" Willie starts to answer. He sees the look on Mr. Untermeyer's face, stops himself, wipes his brow, stabs his spade into the ground. "Honestly, Mr. Untermyer, it's a job. Other bank robbers in the joint, they like to say how thrilling it is to rob a bank, how nothing makes a man feel more alive. That's the bunk, sir. The idea is to do it well, do it fast, get home safe." How much do you believe that he really thought that it was just a job?
Very much. I mean, I think that is a more accurate depiction of his philosophy, his psyche. He could not find other work. He lived in a time of chronic unemployment, bank crises, bank panics, depressions, recessions. He was laid off from several jobs that he had. He decided that he had no choice but a life of crime. I believe, having read what he wrote and read about him, he had an incredible work ethic. And wasn't able to find a healthy outlet for that, and so brought that work ethic to robbing banks. He did believe at his core that a man is his job, that to do a job well is a keystone of manhood. And so he went about planning his bank jobs with this conscientiousness, which is just amazing. And he was a frustrated writer. He was a devoted reader. He channeled his literary impulses into his crimes. And I think that this is one reason he's fascinated so many writers, from Pete Hamill to Saul Bellow, and artists, too. I mean, Willie Sutton has captured the imagination of a wide variety of people. And probably the biggest reason, I think, is that he was such a hard worker. He was so careful and conscientious. He was determined to be, for instance, nonviolent. And in all of his bank robberies and all of his jail breaks, he never fired a single shot. He took great pride in that. He never hurt anybody unduly, as far as we know. I don't mean to suggest that armed robbery is nonviolent, but there's something kind of comical and touching about the way he went about, the care he took in planning his banks. And he writes very convincingly in his memoirs about the fact that robbing a bank was his job, and he did it well, and he took pride in it. It was a craft. It was more than a job. It was a craft. as much as he took pride in robbing banks, breaking out of prison, that was his true art. And he even describes his final prison break as his quote-unquote masterpiece. So that quote that you just read comes straight from my reading of his psyche.
J.R. Moehringer is our guest on the book show this week. The name of the novel is Sutton. It is published by Hyperion. And as I read in the introduction, police called him one of the most dangerous men in New York, but really dangerous only to banks.
I don't fault police for calling him that. I mean, he was a man running around New York with a gun, running around Philadelphia with a gun, holding up banks. I think it's a good thing to consider men like that dangerous. They also, however, called him the Babe Ruth of bank robbers. So even police were incapable of not liking him and mythologizing him. And it's fascinating. Google Willie Sutton. Some of the first pictures that come up are pictures of him when he was finally caught for good in 1952. And notice that the police around him are grinning from ear to ear. And not just because they caught him. They like him. They've just spent a couple hours talking to him. He was, by all accounts, an incredible raconteur, a charmer. You couldn't help but like him. The cops who caught him liked him. The warden and the guards who locked him up liked him. The lawyers who repped him liked him. The judges who sent him away often liked him. His confederates loved him because he famously never, ever spoke the word of an accomplice to the police. He was beaten and never, ever gave the name of any of his accomplices or confederates to authorities. And to this day, he's admired by people in certain walks of life for his refusal to snitch. I've heard some pretty funny stories about criminals who sort of revere Willie Sutton as this, you know, iconic member of their profession because he did the one thing that you're supposed to do, which is he kept his mouth shut. You know, again, it's hard to sanction. I don't mean to sanction this guy. He made terrible life choices, and I'm not validating anything that he did. I'm more interested in his likability. I'm interested in the fact that he became a folk hero because his target was banks. I'm interested in the fact that we have such short memories. We think banks have only recently turned into these greedy vulgarians ruining our country. But in fact, if you read about the time Willie Sutton lived in, this is just deja vu. I read a quote from Coppola about the Godfather. He said, "People think I like gangsters. I don't like these guys. I just think it's interesting that they have a code of honor." And I thought that was very smart. And that was how I approached Willie Sutton. It's not that I think he's a model citizen by any means. And I'm not holding him up as some, you know, exemplar, some template for any of us. But I do think it's interesting that he struck a chord, that what he did didn't just make him, popular. It made him mythic in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. I mean, when he was finally caught in the 50s, crowds gathered around the jail and chanted his name. I think there's a reason behind that.
In reading the book, I was struck by the tone, and it reminded me of one of my favorite novels by one of my favorite novelists, William Kennedy and Legs. There seem to be parallels.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. I read Legs and reread it, and William Kennedy is a hero of mine. You know, Legs Diamond himself was an associate of Willie Sutton. I was inspired by Legs. I was guided by the spirit of that book. I think William Kennedy walked the same line that I've just described. You know, he found Legs likable, but he had his kind of Nick Carraway figure in the book who's observing Legs stuck in a moral quandary. I mean, liking this guy who's also violent and criminal and dangerous. That book is all about trying to reconcile that contradiction, that duality. And there are no easy answers in that book. He gives us a likable Legs Diamond, and then he takes him away, and then he gives him back to us, and then he takes him away. And that's what I try to do with Willie Sutton. Just when you're liking him in my book, he does or says something that kind of puts you off or horrifies you, and then he grows likable again, and then he does something wonderful for someone. He gives away his bank loot to an old lady who's sick in a hospital. And then when he doesn't have to, he goes out and robs more banks and puts more people in danger. So, yes, I mean, you're very kind to say that about William Kennedy, and you're right. That book was at the forefront of my mind when I was writing about this bank robber. It's sort of an unavoidable book if you're writing a historical biography of a criminal, especially if that criminal is an associate of Legs Diamond. So I thank you for that.
How quickly did you have the structure of Sutton being released and talking to these reporters and going back and forth from that car to his wife?
Well, structure is always the last thing to come for me. I always think of Henry James calling structure the sacred mystery. I think that's so true. I think structure is everything. And so naturally it comes last. And for me, I was just drowning in all this material. I started the book as a journalist would. You know, I researched Willie. I read everything I could get my hands on about him, and I read both of his memoirs over and over, and I obtained a bunch of FBI files, and I found some long-missing New York Police Department files. But in the end, I had too much material. I couldn't find a way to synthesize it. And then I realized that when he finally was released from Attica, Christmas Eve, 1969, that was the perfect place to start because there was a media frenzy. Everybody wanted the first interview with him. But as he walked out of prison, two journalists basically scooped him up and held him hostage for 24 hours, drove him around New York City, and made him tell them his life story and took him to the scenes of his greatest heists and the landmarks of his remarkable life. And I started thinking about that day, and the book just really started unfolding in front of me. I thought, that's where the story should take place, in that car, because as a journalist, a former newspaper reporter, I could imagine what it was like inside that car. I've worked many Christmases. I've interviewed guys right when they walked out of prison, and I was the last person they wanted to spend time with. I knew what that must have felt like. I saw from the newspaper article that he gave them nothing, that he already had in mind that he was going to make money off a memoir, so why give it away for free? And I thought it would be interesting to sweep back and forth from that day, Christmas in 1969, to his life, and watch him, this great liar, this virtuoso self-mythologizer, lying to them, lying to himself. I thought it would be fun to toggle you back and forth as a reader between that car, that day, 1969 in New York, and different New Yorks, because every era has a different, completely different New York. And so once I realized I can tell the story in that 24-hour period, everything started to come together. That gave me a structure, and it was a tight structure, and I could have fun with that structure because I really wanted to have fun with this story. And Willie's an Irishman through and through. And so, of course, the story takes place in one day, and there are little subtle allusions to Ulysses. How can there not be in a story about an Irishman who's finally coming home? And Willie was a voracious reader, so that helped a lot. Once I decided that was the way to go, it was remarkable how it all started to fall into place.
With that background, certainly as a journalist, were you helped at all by the background of having written your own memoir, as well as being a ghostwriter for Andre Agassi's biography, that you could look at Sutton's memoirs and read between the lines in some way, shape, or form?
Oh, very much. I don't know if that's cheating or if that's just leaning on old habits to acquire new skills, but I thought many times that I was ghostwriting this ghost's third memoir. I thought many times that I was trying to get inside Willie's head, just as I tried to get inside my own head, writing my memoir, just as I tried to get inside Agassi's head, co-writing his memoir. The only difference was that my access to the real Willie was a little more limited. and that was frustrating, of course. You know, when I would get stuck on the Agassi book, I could just pick up the phone, call him, and what did it smell like? What did it look like? Somehow we didn't talk about this. And those were some of the most enjoyable moments in the process, you know, because you're stuck and then you're immediately unstuck. It's like having a helpline that you can call where they actually help you. and Agassi was so invested in the book. He was so involved, and he was so enthusiastic about it that we just... So those moments were just, they spoiled me, because now when I was stuck on the Willie book, I couldn't call anybody. I could go to his memoirs, but as you say, I was always reading between the lines, and there was a lot of room between the lines because he really lied to both of his ghostwriters. His memoirs are remarkable. To my knowledge, he's the only person in the history of American literature to write two memoirs that completely contradict each other, even on, you know, basic biographical material. So it's your choice. Whatever you choose to believe, you can believe it. And then there's always the third way. There's always the possibility that neither memoir is telling the truth. And there's a line late in the book, the reporter who's taking Willie around New York says, you know, he lived three lives, the one he remembers, the one he tells people about, and then the one that he actually lived.
Right.
And when I wrote that, I thought, well, that's the truest thing I can say about Willie Sutton. But then I realized it's really true of all of us. And having written two memoirs, I know that. I know that to be true. Memory is a game we play. There's nothing certain about memory. And so recognizing that and accepting that also freed me up to not hold myself so tight. When I was trying to decide what had happened in reality, it was helpful to remember that with Willie Sutton, there really is no reality. It's all an educated guess. I say in the author's note, whatever happened to Willie Sutton is anybody's guess, and this book is mine, but it's also my wish. There's a lot of wishful thinking in this book along with educated guessing.
Were you able to look at it in sort of a sociological sense of why we as a public not only are still drawn to the story and still interested in reading your take on it, but at the time were so interested in this man and were rooting for him?
You know, I haven't yet met anybody who has never had the experience of standing in line at the bank and looking around and briefly imagining taking it down. Especially if the line is really long.
Right.
Of course, I have that same fantasy at the post office too, you know. But there's something about us as a culture. I don't know, maybe it's the taboo of it. Maybe it's that it's so dangerous that you know, maybe it's like standing on a cliff. You can't help imagining jumping off. But also, I think it's there is a rebellious strain in this culture. And we each have kind of an antisocial side. We keep it in check all the time, but we're fascinated by people who don't. We're fascinated by people who have no impulse control. We're somehow always congenitally cheered by any kind of a Robin Hood figure because we put up with a lot in this society. Whether we put up with it voluntarily or involuntarily, there are some crazy economic injustices that we've been made to swallow. Banks have been the perpetrators of many of them. I thought I knew how many crimes against this society banks had committed through our history. I didn't. I had no idea about the bank panic of 1907. I had no idea about the crash of 1893. I had no idea how often the whole system has crashed, how much pain. I thought I understood, but reading about the times Willie lived in, the times that preceded those times, I realized that I didn't fully appreciate the true, full texture of the history of economic pain in this country. There are reasons that people choose to break the law. I don't mean to say that they're good reasons, but there are reasons why some people choose to steal. And sometimes those reasons have nothing to do with economics. Sometimes they're all about, you know, chemical imbalance, impulse control problems. But in the case of robbers like Willie Sutton, or I was going to say Dillinger or Capone, but again, they're more violent. Mm. I'm thinking of nonviolent criminals who somehow capture the public imagination. We can't help inwardly rooting for them just a little bit as a culture. The Brits also have a culture of this. They've had some iconic bank robbers in their history, going back to Robin Hood.
Well, the name of the novel is Sutton. It is published by Hyperion. J.R. Moehringer, I thank you very much for being with us. It's such a pleasure to have you on the program and an absolute delight to read the novel. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for being with us. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.